Second appeal for this morning, Ball against Cotter, number 12-1969.
Good morning, Your Honors. Neil Thompson for the appellant's estate.
Hang on. We won't start the clock yet. All right. I think everybody's settled down enough. It's like a changeover in a tennis match. The audience is ready. We're ready. Go ahead,
thank you, Judge.
Mr. Thompson.
My name is Neil Thompson. I represent the estate of Donald Hedstrom in this case, Judge. It comes on motions and cross motions for summary judgment. The very basic facts, Judge, that give rise to the issues here are that the appellant in this case, Donald Hedstrom, retained an agent, Sherry Cotter, for the purchase of two condominiums in Lake Point Tower. He also retained, Sherry Cotter was his agent. That's an undisputed fact. He also retained appellee Hope Geldes as his attorney.
By the way, has anybody signed up for the movie rights for this program?
Not to my knowledge, not, Judge. I hope to get in.
I'm missing a great opportunity, but go ahead.
With regard to condominium unit 4705, ultimately, that was transferred to Mr. Hedstrom and his agent, Ms. Cotter, as joint tenants with rights of survivorship, but he, within 2 months, made out a will in which he at least indicated in that will that it was his property and it should be used to defer the expenses of his estate, although he did inform Ms. Geldes, according to her testimony, that he wanted this unit in joint tenancy with right of survivorship.
He was present for that closing, right?
He was, Judge.
And while she filled it out as joint room?
He was present.
With right of survivorship.
That was her testimony, and that's undisputed in the record. As to Unit 1518, Judge, contrary to what Ms. Geldes said Mr. Hedstrom's instructions were, she took the instructions of the agent, Ms. Cotter, to provide documentation to place that unit not in joint tenancy, but assign it to the Cotter Family Trust. She drafted a power of attorney to accomplish that purpose because Mr. Hedstrom wasn't going to be there. She sent that power of attorney to Ms. Cotter and Mr. Hedstrom and received back a different power of attorney, assigning the attorney in fact rights to Ms. Geldes. She never spoke to him.
Cotter instead of Geldes.
I'm sorry, Ms. Cotter instead of Ms. Geldes. In connection with that transaction, she never spoke to him. She never consulted with him or cleared anything with him. She merely, according to her own testimony, left messages. Now, we believe that these are classically, presumptively fraudulent transactions, and that as to Cotter, the opinion below is fatally flawed on its face. The trial court, from pages 17 to 21, considered and rejected every argument offered by Ms. Cotter for the application of donative intent, a donative intent analysis, noting that the presumption of fraud had to control under Illinois law and that that required clear and convincing evidence on all three of the McPhail factors, which are that the agent made full and frank disclosure of all relevant information, that the consideration was adequate, and that the principal had competent independent advice.
Let me ask you about that, Mr. Thompson. As you read McPhail, where one of the elements is adequate consideration, right?
Yes, sir.
As you read McPhail, it would seem to be impossible for somebody in Mr. Hedstrom's position to make a valid gift to an agent.
That is absolutely correct. That is what Illinois law says.
Impossible.
Virtually impossible. You can't do it this way. An agent is not allowed to take gifts out of commercial transactions in this manner.
Then what do you make out of the Franciscan Sisters case, which does allow donative intent to be shown?
Franciscan Sisters was a will contest.
Yeah, but the Illinois courts cite those two lines of cases back and forth. They're really not that separate, are they?
Well, they actually are that separate, and I admit, Judge, it's sometimes difficult because they're not very precise in the language, but there is a clear distinction between a commercial transaction in which an agent is receiving a commission, as in this case, and a will contest. A will is necessarily a gift. It's always a gift, and as they state under Illinois law, that a gift necessarily does not involve consideration, and that's what a will is. There is some imprecise language, but this is not a will contest, and Illinois law specifically states that an agent taking property from a principal in a commercial transaction must provide consideration. There's no case in Illinois involving a commercial transaction in which an agent was allowed to take a gift in a transaction of this nature and not pay consideration. That, I believe, Judge, is the clear law in Illinois. When the court shifted to a donative intent analysis, as a matter of fact, that is directly contrary and prohibited to or by William, the estate of William Ribault, where the court said, and I quote, if the presumption of fraud can be offset by a presumption of donative intent through joint tenancy with right of survivorship, which is directly on point here, Judge, then greed will often win out. We deem it necessary to hold in this case that the presumption of donative intent as to creation of the Edward D. Jones survivorship account and the Shearson Lehman investment account was outweighed by the presumption of fraud. That being the case, you cannot just shift to a donative intent analysis. Secondly, Judge, directly on point is also the Miller case, which we cited, in which the court explicitly said that with the presumption of fraud having applied, you cannot defeat that or preempt it by putting in the testimony of the decedent's lawyer who said, well, this was consistent with his intent as I understand it. That's exactly what was offered in Miller, and the appellate court said, no, it doesn't work. Again, affirming that you need consideration. Lastly, Judge, in Klaskin v. Klepak, it was, again, almost directly on point. An attorney, an agent, took a trust in a condominium unit, and the court specifically noted that in that case, as in this case, the decedent was given no information by the agent, in that case an attorney, as to what effect it would have on his estate. There's no question in the record here. There was no information whatsoever provided to him regarding how this would affect his estate. And while counsel opposing counsel can argue what the will means and how it can be harmonized, those are just arguments, not undisputed facts. I can also make arguments, as we did below. Judge, as to Ms. Geldes.
Can I ask, before you leave, Scott,
yes,
let me ask one question. As I understand it, the presumption of fraud has to be overcome by clear and convincing evidence, and it's a bursting bubble theory, so you move on from. Who decides under Illinois law whether clear and convincing evidence has burst the bubble? Is it a call that the judge makes and then covers it in jury instructions? Does the judge instruct the jury that you have to, unless you find by clear and convincing evidence these three things, then you must presume that there, you must find that there was fraud? How is that handled in the Illinois courts?
Well, Judge, I have to disagree with your analysis. The bursting bubble cases are all will contest cases. No commercial transaction involving the presumption of fraud has gone into the bursting bubble analysis. They all state clear and convincing evidence on all three points to rebut. And if you do not rebut all three points, the agent loses. It is deemed a fraudulent transaction.
But if you do rebut all three points, is the case over at that point, or does the jury then have to make its own findings?
No, then the jury would have to make its own findings. And I have to note that
that's why I ask, who decides whether the evidence is clear and convincing? Is it a call for the trial judge in deciding what to submit to the jury, or is it entirely up to the jury whether the presumption has been rebutted on all three points by clear and convincing evidence?
I assume, Judge, that would have to go to the jury. That would be a jury instruction. Mm-hmm. And what is important in this case is that Ms. Cotter has conceded that she paid no consideration and conceded flat out in her briefs, I didn't provide him any information at all. She can't possibly rebut it. There is no evidence of any kind. As to Ms. Geldes, if I can get to that quickly, Judge, the whole reason for granting her summary judgment was that there was no expert testimony, but you don't need expert testimony when you have clear standards, as we have in the Code of Professional Regulation or Responsibility, and particularly, Judge, in the Lincoln Cardinal Partners case. Lincoln Cardinal says very clearly that any layperson dealing with an agent for another party who is engaged in self-dealing has a duty to take note of that and bring that to the attention of the principal. Any layperson. if a layperson is obligated to recognize and act on an agent self-dealing, how can an attorney get a pass just because that person is an attorney? That is your classic application of the common knowledge rule. Any juror can look at this in which Illinois law imposes the obligation and make that judgment.
I understand the argument, I guess, if it were Ms. Cotter arguing that Geldes had done a bad job by failing to make sure that these transactions would be sufficiently documented. I don't see how it helps the estate it may have defeated his donative intent, assuming that was there, but that doesn't hurt the estate.
It is evidence, at least as to 1518 in particular. I submit her conduct was egregious on 1518. She allowed an agent engaged in clear self-dealing to instruct her to transfer $500,000 worth of his property to the agent, and she never even once spoke to her client. That judge is in clear violation of CPR 1.1, 1.2, and 1.4. Opposing counsel has cited no case in which an attorney has acted in this manner and discharged her obligations to inform the client, consult with the client, and explain things to the client by leaving messages that were never returned. The trial court said that the power of attorney demonstrated that he knew and understood. But again, Judge, that is flatly improper under Pruder v. Bork. The power of attorney is presumptively fraudulent on its face. And the controlling law says you need clear and convincing evidence apart from the power of attorney to prove that he knew. There is no such evidence, Judge. So we believe in this case that as to both of these defendants, judgment should enter, and at the very least, we should be entitled to a trial against Ms. Geldes.
You're under your rebuttal time.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor. Thank you, and I will reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Kuznier?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Jason Kuznier. I represent Attorney Hope Geldes. Plaintiff's position in this case that no expert is required on the malpractice claim against Ms. Geldes is by necessity because their expert was barred by the district court, first by the magistrate judge who found their disclosure to be untimely and barred that, and also upheld by Judge Dow. Plaintiff's proposition is that the rules of Illinois civil or the rules of professional conduct are dispositive of the case. There's no dispute, Your Honors, that under Illinois law, and plaintiff doesn't make this dispute, that generally speaking, attorney malpractice claims must be proved through expert testimony, not only what the standard of care is, but also that the attorney's conduct violated that standard of care or deviated from that standard of care. Plaintiff's position that no expert is required is unsustainable for several reasons. First, the cases that they cite to, other than Rogers, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case, have nothing to do with the legal malpractice. They all have to do with either real estate brokers or other professionals, but do not involve attorney malpractice claims in Illinois, nor the requirement that Illinois attorneys only be subject to liability based on expert testimony of the standard of care and the breach thereof. The common knowledge exception that I think Mr. Thompson alluded to is very limited in scope. The cases that find the common knowledge exception to apply are where there's such an open and obvious issue, such as a statute of limitations that an attorney had not met in filing a complaint or state taxes or whatnot. This is not this case. I'll be very brief. Barth versus Regan is a case that's dispositive. It's an Illinois Supreme Court case from 1990. It distinguishes Rogers, which plaintiff relies on. It has a situation where there's the potential for conflict of interest, which the Barth court said required expert testimony. It dealt with the mode and method of communication with a client and how information is provided to a client. The court found that that also required expert testimony.
It's still pretty – the evidence on 1518 is pretty troubling.
Your Honor, actually, it's not troubling. So with 1518 –
Well, it depends who's troubled, I guess.
I'm sorry?
I'm troubled.
I will tell you.
Comfort.
I will give you comfort, Judge. So on 1518, the testimony was that it was to be titled to both Cotter and Hedstrom as joint tenants. Ms. Cotter advises by way of email to Ms. Gelds that it should be titled to the Cotter Family Trust. Ms. Geltz prepares an email to both Ms. Cotter and Mr. Hedstrom of that, that what the ramifications of that would be, that, that Mr. Hedstrom would have no interest whatsoever in the 1508 property. She sends an email attaching a power of attorney. She leaves him a voicemail message, and she also sends a fax. There is case law, Your Honor.
She sends things, no doubt. What does she get back in return?
The signed power of attorney, which
is different, right? Because instead of making her the power of the attorney, it makes
the testimony was that Ms. Geltz prepared it both. Originally, it was Mr. Hedstrom was not going to be attending. The question was whether Ms. Cotter was going to be in attendance at the closing. So originally, it was prepared with Ms. Geltz as being the agent in fact for purposes of the closing. And then when Ms. Cotter said that she would be attending, that was changed, and she was nominated to be the attorney in fact for that closing. But what is important here is that plaintiffs don't challenge that power of attorney was signed by Mr. Hedstrom. The plaintiffs don't challenge that the email, the fax, and voicemails were not received. There is no evidence of that. And based on the case law, we've cited it in our brief, emails sent are presumed delivered and received absent evidence to the contrary. This isn't the first email communication that Ms. Geld sent to Mr. Hedstrom. She had communicated with him by email before, and he responded before. So it's a good email address, sent to the same email address. There's no allegation or evidence to suggest that that information provided by Ms. Geld to Mr. Hedstrom was not received by him. Also, Your Honor, with respect to the will, there's only one way to interpret this will. 1508 is not in the will for the reason that Mr. Hedstrom had no interest in that property. That will is prepared after the fact, so he full well knows that he has no interest whatsoever in 1508. With respect to 4705, he provides for distribution or gifting of that property because it's joint tenants with right of survivorship. His estate attorney must provide for the situation where Ms. Cotter may predecease Mr. Hedstrom, in which case Mr. Hedstrom has a full and sole interest in that property. Thank I see my time there. Is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Trainor?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Daniel Trainin. I represent Sherry Cotter and the Cotter Family Trust. I want to address a couple of points that opposing counsel made before I get into my spiel. First, with respect to the McPhail factors, he seems to indicate, and he responded, that it would be impossible to give a gift to an agent in a commercial transaction. But if you look at McPhail, and if you look at Klaskin, and if you look at Miller, each of those cases don't say that these McPhail factors are elements that you must, each of which you must meet in order to overcome the presumption of fraud. The McPhail court refers to them as important factors in determining whether the transaction is fair and complete. The Klaskin case says some of the factors in which this court deems persuasive in determining whether the presumptions of undue influence have been overcome include the showing of the factors. The Miller Court says three significant factors that have been recognized in overcoming the presumption of fraud. These are not factors where if you don't meet one of them, you fail to overcome the presumption of fraud. They're advisory for they're factors for the court to consider when weighing the evidence as to whether or not there's clear and convincing evidence that the presumption has been overcome.
Ultimately, though, it has to be overcome by clear and convincing evidence?
That is correct.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Thompson. Is that a procedural issue that the trial judge decides before deciding what to instruct the jury, or is it left to the jury to decide whether clear and convincing evidence has overcome the presumption? If so, you find this. If not, you must find that.
I think it's based upon the language in the Franciscan Sisters. I think it's pretty clear that it's a presumption that the judge must determine, and then if the judge determines that the presumption has been overcome, then there is no presumption to give to the jury as part of the jury instructions. If it has not been overcome, then the jury would include that in the presumption. So I think this is a factor for the trial judge to consider. And with respect to the question of whether the bursting bubble even applies, I think it's pretty clear that it does. It applies to all presumptions, is what the Franciscan court and the court that it relied upon indicated. That's how Illinois deals with presumptions. And of course, once the presumption has been overcome, it disappears. It's not evidence, and you are left with whatever evidence is in the case. And if you look at what evidence is in this case, there is no evidence that Sherry Cotter breached any fiduciary duty to Mr. Hedstrom. None. The plaintiffs have, or the appellants in this case, have set up a neat little loophole in the law where they can take the presumption of fraud, create a prima facie case with that presumption of fraud, and use that as a sword to prove a case without any evidence. And then at the same time, they took the Illinois Dead Man's Act, used it as a shield to prevent Ms. Geldes and Ms. Cotter, or attempt to preclude Ms. Geldes and Ms. Cotter from defending themselves. The key factors in the Miller case, in the Klaskin case, in the Franciscan sisters, in all of the relevant cases here, the key factor that was identified by the court as to whether or not a presumption of fraud would be overcome in the giving of a gift is whether or not the person had full knowledge and whether or not they had independent legal advice. There is no question in this case that Mr. Hedstrom had independent legal advice and full knowledge based about these transactions based upon the undisputed facts, including Ms. Geldes' testimony, which for purposes of this appeal, there's no question that her testimony is admissible. The Dead Man's Act does not apply. That issue was never raised on appeal by the appellants. Those factors include, for 4705, that Mr. Hedstrom told Ms. Geldes that he wanted the Cotter to have both condo units upon his death, that Mr. Hedstrom sent an email indicating that he wanted to take 4705 jointly with Ms. Cotter, that Ms. Geldes gave Mr. Hedstrom independent legal advice regarding the manner in which he could take it jointly, giving him each of his options and explaining what each option would mean. Mr. Hedstrom told Ms. Geldes on the phone and at the closing that he wanted to take it jointly with rights of survivorship. I don't think there's any question that 4705, that there is clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Hedstrom's testamentary desires or his desires with respect to how these condominium units would be titled were met by the legal services provided by Ms. Geldes and by the ultimate transaction that occurred in this case. With respect to 1518, again, I think the evidence is overwhelming. It is overwhelming because there's no contrary evidence. There's no question that Mr. Hedstrom told Ms. Geldes that he wanted both condos to go to Ms. Cotter. There's no question that that Cotter requested Geldes prepare the power of attorney on behalf of Mr. Hedstrom. The power of attorney had the effect of transferring 1518 to the Cotter Family Trust. Ms. Geldes, however, is the one who prepared the power of attorney and emailed it to Mr. Hedstrom. There is no mystery with respect to these power of attorneys. The power of attorney that was, if you look at the deposition testimony of Ms. Geldes, it's in the record at Supplemental Appendix 135. It indicates that Ms. Geldes prepared the power of attorney, assigning the rights to 1518 to the Cotter Family Trust for Ms. Cotter to handle at the closing. Thereafter, Ms. Cotter had a question that she might not be able to attend the closing, so a second power of attorney was prepared. It was never executed, however, because Ms. Cotter determined that she could go to the closing. That's the mystery here. There is no mystery. That's what happened. In each case, however, the Cotter Family Trust was going to get the property. So it wouldn't have mattered which one had been signed, because at the end of the day, the result that was demanded by the power of attorney was affected. The final question as to whether Mr. Hedstrom was whether the court could reasonably rely upon Mr. Hedstrom's receipt of the email and the phone message, et cetera, and so that we know that Mr. Hedstrom understood what was going on, is evidenced by the fact that, A, he signed that power of attorney before a witness and before a notary, and he returned it to Ms. Geldes. Number two, he was continuously involved in this transaction throughout this process. If you look at the if you go back to the record, you will see in Ms. Geldes' testimony that Geldes had a call with Mr. Hedstrom regarding the fact that he wasn't going to have funds available to complete the transaction for 15-18 in time, and that they were going to have to extend the closing. That's at page 130 of the supplemental appendix. Later on, they had a call as to when they were going to have the closing for 15-18. That's at 133 in the supplemental appendix. They had a call about giving sellers credit at closing. That's at page 134 in the supplemental appendix. And most importantly, at page 138 of the supplemental appendix, there was a call by Mr. Hedstrom to Ms. Geldes regarding his need for wire instructions for closing. How did he get those wire instructions? Ms. Geldes emailed them to him, and then he took those instructions and he wired the money to complete the closing for 15-18. There is a pattern of communication going back and forth between these two, so that there was no reason for anybody to believe that Mr. Hedstrom did not completely understand what he had done and intended for 15-18 to go to the Cotter Family Trust.
That's an inference, isn't it, as to what you get from this pattern? And ordinarily, on summary judgment, the district court has to draw all inferences, all reasonable inferences, against the moving party. Aren't you claiming benefit of an inference?
Well, I think these are all facts which support maybe an inference, but I think that what they do is they establish that and the only inference that's coming is that, well, the inference is that he read the email, but I think the law presumes that he read that email. That the law presumes that he read the power of attorney, and that he because he signed it.
Isn't his intent itself an inference?
At the end of the day, he's dead. We're never going to know. We're going to have to make some inferences in order to in this case. But I think because there is no evidence going the other way on 15-18, no evidence at all that he had any other intent but to give that condominium 15-18 to the Cotter Family Trust. That the judge had no choice but to find that in favor of the defendants.
Thank you, Mr. Kuznier. Rebuttal, Mr. Thompson. How much time? 3 minutes?
I think the most important point that I have to stress on rebuttal, Judge, is that the facts absolutely do not demonstrate that Ms. Geldes prepared the power of attorney she received back. She prepared two powers of attorney, both of which were for her to act. One for Sherry Cotter, because Sherry Cotter said she might not attend closing, and one for Ms. Geldes to act as Mr. Hedstrom's power of attorney. The Sherry Cotter affidavit was never necessary. It was never executed. However, there is no evidence as to who prepared the affidavit that she, Ms. Geldes, received back, making Sherry Cotter the power of attorney for Mr. Hedstrom. There is no evidence. I have her affidavit in my hand. It's document 44.5, and you can see that yourself, Judge. She sent one. She got another one back. She never said that she actually created the second affidavit. Second, Judge, counsel keeps arguing, both attorneys, that there's a presumption that he received this. Judge, we have to have clear and convincing evidence. You cannot dispose of an issue on which clear and convincing evidence is required by citing a presumption. You simply can't do that.
Why not? The presumption says it is the fact unless the presumption is rebutted. Why can't you use a presumption?
A presumption is not evidence. I have the presumption in my favor that this power of attorney was fraudulent.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's get to the definition of evidence. My last recollection was it was any means by which the finder of fact has to assert, to come to a conclusion on this of the facts. With evidences, it can be an inference, it can be all sorts of things.
That might be, Judge, but there's no evidence that he received this evidence.
Is there an inference he received it, a presumption?
I don't believe that a presumption that would ordinarily apply serves to defeat an issue on which clear and convincing evidence is required.
So it's a presumption against a presumption?
Well, they have to produce clear and convincing evidence that he knew and understood.
You've never heard of an irrebuttable presumption.
No, there is. That would be correct, Judge. If they had
I'm just ascertaining whether or not presumption can be evidence, and it can be.
but it can't defeat a requirement for clear and convincing evidence.
Well, that's yours.
And as to a very important point, Judge, counsel says that each of these 3 points does not require clear and convincing evidence. I cite Monco v. Janus, which explicitly says Monco was required to prove by clear and convincing evidence the 3 McPhail factors, all 3. Lastly, Judge, I would ask you to look at Monco carefully on this issue of consideration, because in that case, the attorney who was ultimately not entitled to take the gift from this transaction, if you want to look at it that way, not only contributed, I believe, $13,000, but did all kinds of legal work in connection with it, and the court still said that consideration is inadequate. To your point, Judge, to get to a jury, you have to have some consideration, and there is none by her admission.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. The case is taken under advisement.